Years ago, we had a problem with our transmissions. And the problem was that Leggett and Jones, where I normally get our cars worked on, don't do transmissions. So I went to Guy. See, Tony knows a guy. My guy is a guy. I asked Guy, can you recommend a good transmission shop? And he said, no. No. And then he went on to explain that there used to be two really good transmission shops in the area, but the guy that owned them had retired, and his both cases, the sons had taken over the business, and they ran it into the ground. I mean, they charged too much. They did lousy work. And so he said, basically, there aren't any good ones. That's been about 15 years ago. Maybe one has sprung up in the meantime. But that's just kind of what happens a lot of times. The American dream is to start your own business, to work hard and build it from scratch, to develop a reputation in the area and turn that business into a success. But then so often what happens, there is the Ecclesiastes complaint after you've built that business up. Ecclesiastes 2 and verse 17. I hated all the things that I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to the one who comes after me, and who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish. And yet they will have control over all the fruit of my toil, which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. So you work, you work, you work, and then you finally turn your successful business over to the kid, and he is foolish and destroys it. That's why my dad did not bless me with Tucker office equipment. He decided by looking at my business skills and sales ability, and particularly my ability to not be able to do mechanical stuff with typewriters, you need to go to college and learn how to preach. The second generation very often is not motivated or as focused on success as is the first generation. In fact, we might use the word entropy here. That's the scientific term, right? Where the system runs down. There's a continual order to disorder, to chaos. And that's what happens sometimes with the second generation. But that's what we're going to call it today, is the second generation syndrome. The great generation, the war generation, appreciated freedom in such a personal way because they were the ones that went through the Great War and fought and won our freedom with their sweat and with their blood. But then comes along the baby boomers, of which I'm one, afterwards, and we can't appreciate freedom exactly the same way that they did. And what we became focused on, right, is enjoying the success and prosperity that the generation before us handed down. There is a constant movement toward that, and that's what we're going to see in Israel. As we continue the story, we come to the story of the judges. It's the period right after Joshua has led the children of Israel into the promised land. They have enjoyed success. There was that one defeat that they suffered at Ai. They got back in focus with God. And then for 7 years, Joshua leads them to victory after victory after victory, until finally they are enjoying what God had promised all along, the blessing of the promised land given to them. The land was divided and into all of the tribes. The families were given their plot of that land, and now the real work of the conquest begins as they make new lives and settle into the promised land. We mentioned in class this morning the influence of Joshua and how he cast such a large shadow in Israel, that Israel served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and the elders who outlived him and who had experienced everything that the Lord had done for Israel. So as long as Joshua was alive, they followed after God. That can't be said for too many leaders. And what really can't be said for too many leaders in this story that we're going to is that the people that knew Joshua, the leaders that had served under him, as long as they were around, the people were faithful to God and followed him. Joshua was a great leader. But soon a generation arose that didn't know Joshua, and they didn't know God in the way that they should have. They hadn't participated in the great wars. They hadn't seen the mighty acts of God. And now, all of a sudden, the story of Israel is not their story anymore. It's not what they're focused on. Our reading this morning comes from Judges 2, verses 10 and 11. After the whole generation had been gathered to their ancestors, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals. They forsook the Lord, the God of their ancestors, had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshiped various gods and the peoples of the peoples around them. They aroused the Lord's anger because they forsook him and served Baal and the Asherahs. What we see in Judges is the failure of God's people after he gives them what he's been promising all along. You remember, they balked, that first generation, the ones that actually left Egypt, when it was time to go in. They didn't want to face the giants. They didn't want to face the walled cities. But now, this generation that has been brought up has gone in. They faced the giants. They faced the walled cities. They won the victory. But the generation that came after them, that second generation of Israelite in the promised land, is turning away from God. So what we're going to look at this morning is that second generation syndrome, how it was in Israel and how it impacts us as well. There's a couple of things about this second generation. First, they were satisfied with the victories of the past. Joshua had emphasized how God had done everything that God was supposed to do, that he had met all of his promises, that he led them to victory after victory. And in fact, in verse 44, now one of their enemies withstood them, and the Lord gave them all their enemies into their hands. Not one of all the Lord's good promises to Israel failed. Every one was fulfilled. What powerful statement that is. Not one of God's promises failed. They never do. God came through. But the Israelites didn't really. Even that first generation that was faithful to God didn't carry the conquest as far as they needed to. So we have this series of statements in Judges chapter 1. The first time is in verse 27. The Benjamites, however, did not drive out the Jebusites who were living in Jerusalem. And to this day, the Jebusites live there with the Benjamites. They conquered the land, but then they stopped. It's repeated again in verse 27, verse 29, verse 30, verse 31, and verse 33 that, okay, the tribes drove out the people, but they did not drive out all of the people that they were supposed to. They left those folks in the land, and more specifically, what was left with the ites here, the Jebusites, that lived in the land was the idols, the false gods that they worshipped. And God said that this would become a test for Israel. In chapter 2, verse 22, I will use them, the people that you've left and their false gods, to test Israel to see whether they will keep the way of the Lord and walk in it as their ancestors did. Because there were still things to do, God said, this will be a test. This will see if the second generation is going to be as faithful as the first generation. But it also became, he said, a trap. And I have also said, I will not drive out before you. They will become traps to you, and their gods will become snares to you. The test, because they didn't pass it, now is a trap. You know, James tells us that we can count it joy when we go through trials, tests of many kinds, because that develops our faith. But if we don't respond in that way, then the same thing that can test us and make us stronger can become a trap that can pull us down. And God says that these people that you've left in the land and their false gods are going to become a test to you. What God wanted was for the second generation to carry through with the conquest. He wanted them to follow him and do exactly what their forefathers had done. The first generation did God's work, but they hadn't completed it. And now it's time for the second generation to pick up that mantle and to carry it through, to continue to do the same thing. But that's not what happens. What we read about in chapter 3 and verse 5, the Israelites lived among all the other ites, the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. They lived among them. They didn't drive them out as God had wanted them to do. And they took their daughters in marriage and gave their own daughters to their sons and served their gods. Rather than carrying forth the task that God had laid out for them, they decided to settle in and settle down and become like the peoples around them. And it wasn't long until they were worshiping the false gods of these people around them. Rather than continue the conquest, they settled in and settled down and became like the Canaanites. Daniel Burstyn has said that the disciples of discoverers are the enemies of discovery. Now, that's just another way of talking about this second generation syndrome. When the discoverers come, they push and they explore and they push the boundaries back. The generation that comes after them have a tendency to appreciate the discoveries of the first, and they appreciate to the point where they camp and don't push it any further. Rather than continuing the discovery, they become the appreciators of the discovery of the discoverers, and therefore they become enemies of doing more discovery. I mean, think about the Protestant Reformation. Luther and people like him decided on sola scriptura, the scriptures alone. And they found some things that people weren't doing that God wanted them to do, and how the Bible needs to be the only authority, and we're going to stand on the Bible alone. Well, Luther dies, and the generation that comes after him, rather than continuing to discover, continuing to push, continuing to try to get closer and closer to what God says, they made a creed out of what Luther discovered, and they didn't go any further than that. They worship the discovery that Luther found. The same thing happened in our movement, what we call sometimes the Restoration Movement, the desire to stand on the Bible, sola scriptura. Here comes Alexander Campbell and some men like him, and they decide that the Bible is alone, not the creeds that had been formed, not the traditions that had been formed, but only the Bible. And so they begin to discover things that weren't right in the way that we responded to God. But the generation that came after them, rather than continuing that restoration, continuing that discovery, continue that pilgrimage, they camped and made what the first generation found the authority. And so we are orthodox, we are biblical, if we appreciate and follow what Campbell and those guys found. Well, you see, you can be a camper or you can be a pilgrim. What you can't be is both at the same time. I like what somebody said, that you can always tell the pioneers by the arrows in their backs. Those who push, those who continue to discover, who leave what has been found by the first generation and continue to look for more truth, will sometimes find they're being shot in the back by the people that are unwilling to leave the camp. That we can either choose to follow God and to seek His will, or we can appreciate what's been done before us. It's hard to do both. An example, years and years ago when we started talking about praise teams for the first time, I had somebody say, this was years before we actually had one, but what they said was, well, a praise team is the same thing as a choir, and the church decided 100 years ago that we weren't going to do that. Well, that's so wrong. And first of all, it's not true that the church has always rejected, that our fellowship has rejected that sort of thing. But secondly, there has nothing been settled 100 years ago. God calls us to faithfulness and to pilgrimage and to conquer in every generation. We cannot simply camp on what's done before us. We've got to carry the search for truth on. And what's been decided by the previous generation can be something that we can start with, but we can't just camp there. If we settle in and settle down and get comfortable, we're repeating the mistake of the Israelites. Secondly, the Israelites wanted the blessing of the promised land without the work that went along with it. Remember, what God wanted them to do was to continue to push against those ites and to continue to get rid of the false gods of the people around them. But what they did is they settled in and settled down and they started marrying the people that were around them. And they started worshiping their gods and they started being just like them. And God holds them accountable. That is the foundation of what's going to happen in the book of Judges, as we talked about in class. Moses said this would happen. Remember the text I think we read when we were looking at Deuteronomy. He said that when the Lord brings you into the land He swore to your forefathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you a land, a large land, flourishing with cities that you did not build, houses filled with all kinds of good things you did not provide, wells that you did not dig, and vineyards and olive groves that you did not plant. When you eat and are satisfied, be careful. Here's what the tendency is going to be. Be careful that you do not forget the Lord who brought you out of Egypt and out of the land of slavery. Oh, Israel knew they needed God while they were in the desert. I mean, how are you going to feed a million or a million and a half people in the desert? It's going to take an act of God. Now, they complained about the manna, but they sure ate it the whole time they were in the desert because that's all they had. You can't just pull in the desert and pull into a McDonald's somewhere and order a million and a half cheeseburgers. That's just not going to work. You have to rely on God. The problem is you move into the land that flows in milk and honey and all the things they have at their disposal. Now they think they don't need God. We can supply everything that we need. And God is forgotten, and the way of God is forgotten, and they start to become like the people around them. The word that you hear a lot today is the word entitlement. Some feel entitled to success and prosperity. Kids see what their parents have and get used to it, get used to be given everything, and they think they're entitled to that. They want the product of prosperity without the work that it takes to get there. And in essence, that's what God is accusing Israel of here. Therefore, the Lord was very angry with Israel and said, because this nation has violated the commandment I ordained to their ancestors and has not listened to me, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations Joshua left when he died. You think that prosperity, you think that blessedness is supposed to come just because you are the chosen people. If you don't act like the chosen people, then that's going to be taken away. And that's a warning to the church today. We can start acting like we're entitled to the goodness of God without being willing to follow Him in the ways that we're called to do. So what do we do about that? What do we do about this tendency of the second generation to settle in, settle down, and get comfortable? Well, a couple of things. First of all, we need to recognize what this tendency looks like. And just a few things. First of all, we tend to focus and fight over the external forms and formats of church. That faithfulness to us is what we do at church. And so what really matters to us is how we do church. And we start fussing and fighting over every little detail that relates to how we do church while we're together. And what is lost in all of that is the importance of living our faith while we're out in the world. So that means that there is a loss of urgency of the importance of faith. When we leave this place, we don't go out and feel an urgent desire, an urgent need to live our faith before others, to live by the calling of God, to invite others to the goodness of God. We come to church and we do our religious stuff and we leave it here and then we go out with no sense of urgency. And secondly, that means we become more and more likely to do what Israel did and compromise with the standards of the world. The ethics, the values, the things the world thinks are important become important to us. And so that's how we live, just the way that Israel did. So what do we do about that? I mean, that is the tendency of the second generation, to lose that sense of urgency, to make religion only about externals and then to compromise. So what do we do about that? It's all about our vision. Remember what caused Israel to fall into this vicious cycle that becomes repeated over and over again, as we talked about in class this morning in the book of Judges. They couldn't learn after repeating it seven times. They're still at a loss. The problem was they lost their vision of God. They forgot who God was. They forgot the mighty acts that God had done among their forefathers. They forgot about the power, the glory, and the goodness of who God was. And because of that, it caused them not to see who they were to be. And that's the way it is with us. When we forget who God is, when God becomes just a story that's not our story, when the mighty acts that we read about, both in the scriptures and also in the lives of people of faith, if those become just stories, and doesn't become our story, then we are just completely disconnected from the power, the majesty, the glory, and the goodness of God. In Romans chapter 11, Paul is, well, actually in chapters 9 through 11, Paul is doing this very intricate and kind of rabbinic sounding argument trying to answer the question that the church had. Well, if Gentiles are included, the Jews are no longer the special chosen people of God, has God broke his promise? And so he's kind of involved in telling this, making this an answer to that question. But in the middle, or rather at the end of it, in talking about God, Paul is just moved to worship God. He can't talk about God. And this, he interrupts himself all through his writings to have a doxology or a word of praise. And here's how he ends Romans chapter 11. Oh, the depth of the riches of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable his judgments and his paths beyond tracing out. Who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has been his counselor? Who has ever given to God that God should repay them? For from him and through him and for him are all things. To him be glory forever. Amen. Paul is just overwhelmed by the power and the person and the goodness of God. And that's what we need to be driven by. We don't need to be talking about just forms and formats about how we do church and about and leave it at church. We need to be totally overwhelmed by who God is. We need to have that vision in our mind, because that vision will go with us into our, you know, we talk about sometimes in a prayer phrase, and you've probably heard this, maybe some of you have prayed this, and now go with us as we go into our normal walk of life. It always sounds boring when you say it that way. Because most of us don't have lives that are just super exciting, right? If you do, we need you to share your story with us. Because most of it is a rather mundane and normal. But when we say that, you know, okay, we come to church. And in church, it's how great thou art. And then we go to our normal walk of life. How great thou art is just as applicable to your job and to your neighborhood and to the other aspects of your normal walk of life. And that's what we need to recapture. Years ago, I cut a little article out of the Gospel Advocate, and in that was probably 30 years ago, when Guyon Woods was the editor of the Gospel Advocate. That might have been 40 years ago. I don't know. It's a long time ago. He hasn't been with us in a long time. He had this little article, and in fact, all I saved was the end of it. And this doesn't sound like the normal way that Guyon Woods would sound. Normally, he would say something like, "It never ceases to amaze me what some of my brethren will say," and then he'll light into some false understanding or something. But here's how he ended that article. "To know him is eternal life. The heavens above ceaselessly preach his glory. The vast firmament daily exhibits his handiwork. His wondrous word reveals his character, our obligation, the world's destiny. May the divine music of the spheres ring in our ears, soothe our hearts, and bring us to him through his word. God grant us that we be joined in the heavenly chorus, and with David say, 'I will sing with Jehovah as long as I live. I will sing praise to my God while I have any being. Let my meditation be sweet unto him. I will rejoice in Jehovah.'" That's got to become the focus of our lives. Not just what we do in church, but who we are and what we're about as we go through those normal avenues of our life. God needs to be our focus. And when we understand the glory and the power and the goodness of God, then we are motivated to live in what he tells us, and not to fall into worshiping the false gods around us, and not to become like the people of the world. Because we are called to be the children of God. John says in John 3, verse, that's what we are, and that's what we need to live like. Let's pray together.